The Park Inn in Mason City is a 100-year-old hotel designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. A nonprofit group is restoring the building, and it will be open for business in June 2011. Completed in 1910, the Park Inn Hotel is the last remaining Frank Lloyd Wright-designed hotel in the world. In today's archive edition of Talk of Iowa, Jonathan Aull speaks with Ann McGregor of Wright on the Park and architect Martha Huntington of the firm Berglund & Cram. They give us an update on the project.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. We start our show today talking about Frank Lloyd Wright and a very special building that he designed in Mason City. It's the only remaining hotel that Frank Lloyd Wright designed that is still standing and could be used for that purpose. Joining me to talk about the status of the renovation is Ann McGregor. She's the executive director of Wright on the Park, and Martha Huntington, who is the architect involved in this renovation process. Thank you both for joining us on Talk of Iowa today.
Sure. Our pleasure.
Let's start by just, for those listeners that may not be aware of the Park Inn Hotel, can we maybe just get a brief history on how we got to where we are now, which is a property that's it's very close to being completely renovated?
Well, Wright on the Park was organized as a not-for-profit in March of 2005 because the city council of Mason City asked for someone to step forward to take on this project. The city wanted nothing to do with it. And so a group of us came together, Martha included. We formed the not-for-profit, and our mission statement from day one has been that Wright on the Park will own, preserve, restore, and maintain the historic Park Inn Hotel in Mason City, Iowa.
Tell us a little bit about the building and its history.
Frank Lloyd Wright designed the Park Inn Hotel and City National Bank building, which are is one common structure. It opened in 1910. So coming up this September, we're celebrating its centennial anniversary. And so since the inception of WOTP, Wright on the Park, not-for-profit, we have worked toward obtaining all of the funding necessary. It's approximately an $18 million project. And we just finalized our funding the end of January this year, and so that allowed us to move full steam ahead. Bids were let last autumn, and so as soon as we had our final funding, Martha and the construction manager kicked everything into high gear with all of the contractors and full steam ahead.
Martha, what this building in the overall scheme of Frank Lloyd Wright designs, because I think most people are probably more familiar with his homes. What can you tell us a little bit about the building, its architectural significance, and maybe what someone who's seen Frank Lloyd Wright homes may recognize in it and what they might not recognize in it?
Well, it is, he obviously did not do as many commercial buildings as he did homes, so it is important for that respect. Also because it was a combination of three different functions in one complete building, which is sort of unusual in the United States just because we have so much land, we typically don't need to combine functions in one building. It came at sort of the midway point between a project that's known as Midway Gardens and the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. And it carries some of the same massing, some of the same detailing, and it follows in the line of where he was in his experimentation with the Prairie School. It really has the most in common with those two buildings. It has two separate masses that are combined with a waste, which what we've been referring to, and they are each symmetrical in and of themselves. And then very much like the both buildings, the hotel itself, as you move up the building on the exterior, the masses also ascend in levels that are very similar. Primarily the interior finishes are plaster and trim. The plaster itself has a sand float finish, which is what he used in many of his homes. The dark wood trim is also very much like what we think of with the Prairie School period. There was a lot of art glass, which is another thing he was known for in his homes and in his public buildings during that time. We also have a lot of terracotta, polychromatic terracotta, that is on the exterior of the buildings and makes it very identifiable.
So, in having been to the hotel myself, the kind of how there isn't really, it feels like the floors are not very traditional. It's not like there's a first floor and then a second floor. It's these overlapping terraces and mezzanine levels, and a lot of that was in a lot of the Prairie School homes that he did as well, right?
Correct. And the very low roofs, the low pitch roofs, and the cantilevers are also very reminiscent of his homes.
So to what extent are you going to be able to restore this hotel to what it looked like when it opened in 1910?
Well, in some ways it will be much nicer than when it opened. His Prairie School homes and commercial buildings are relatively plain on the interior in that they're just painted. There wasn't fancy wallpaper. There wasn't fancy gold leaf or any of that sort of thing. And it will look very much like that. Where we're going to upgrade things are in the bathrooms for the guests. We're putting carpet in through much of the building with the exception of a few public spaces. We're trying to be true to its original presence, but upgrade it for modern travelers, because we know ultimately it has to float economically. So that means we need to have occupancy and bring people back, and we have to make it comfortable for today's travelers.
And a lot of that relates to the fact that what a traveler expects out of a hotel room has changed dramatically in the last 100 years.
Absolutely. Originally, there were shared bathrooms for the hotel guests, and there is no way that people nowadays would want to do that. The rooms are quite small, and we're making them slightly larger with the exception of two historic rooms, so that we can accommodate modern furniture. Modern bathroom fixtures take up more space, and people use their rooms much differently than they did originally. Now we tend to stay in our rooms and watch television. That's something that never would have been thought of, obviously. Travelers went into their rooms, and then they usually went downstairs and used the restaurants and went out on the streets and went to the stores. And while we want to encourage that for economic development, we do know that there are some people who will go into their room, turn on the TV, and never leave. So we have to make sure that they're taken care of also.
That historic room sounds interesting. What's that all about?
Well, it's a pair of rooms that are going to be restored to their original size, which is roughly 10 by 10. And it will have a shared bathroom. They'll each have a closet, and people can access the other room through the bathroom. Now, some people, we figure, will want to rent both rooms so they don't have to share the bathroom. But there are some people who have expressed an interest in experiencing what the hotel was like originally, and that includes having to accommodate someone else, a stranger, in another room.
We've been encouraged by the Frank Lloyd Wright aficionados who come to Mason City just to see the hotel. And when we've taken them through the hotel, numerous of these folks have encouraged us to at least retain two of the historic pair of rooms.
I would also think that that might be a good setup for a family of four,
yes,
or two couples that are spending a weekend together as well.
Absolutely.
What's the time frame now that all the financing is in place? And what's the time frame for when might somebody be able to make a reservation at the Park Inn?
Well, let me back up to the, as I say, the construction is fully underway now. The chain link fences are up, the contractors' trailers, the dumpsters, et cetera. We're projecting a 16-month time frame. Hopefully no major surprises that will delay that, but the reopening of the hotel will be June of 2011. We are in the process of selecting a hotelier. We hope to have that process completed by the end of April this year.
And that's someone to run the hotel?
Correct. We will continue to own the properties, but the hotelier is responsible for the day-to-day management of the hotel itself, including the restaurant and banquet facilities, the beverage and food service. But so I would imagine that the hotelier will start pretty aggressive marketing 6 to 9 months out of opening in June of 2011.
We were talking just a little bit about the finances and about how the goal is for this to be self-sustaining. Can you take just a moment to describe how much money this is going to cost and where that money is coming from?
Well, as I referenced earlier, it's approximately an $18 million project, and the sources of funds have been cobbled together through a variety of ways. State of Iowa legislative appropriations, the Department of Cultural Affairs. We were named an Iowa Great Place. We received a tremendous Vision Iowa award of $8.2 million. State historic tax credits, federal historic tax credits, and our most recent final piece of funding came through the allocation of new markets tax credits, complements of Iowa business growth in Johnston, Iowa.
So it sounds like the predominant funding is coming from various grants from the public sector. Is there much private money involved in the project?
There has been. And over the years, we've received substantial grant dollars from the area foundations, for example, and certainly private donations from individuals and businesses, but the bulk of it has come through those sources that I mentioned. Plus, the project has received two Save America's Treasures grant. We had a $500,000 award for the hotel part itself, and currently we have a $394,000 Save America's Treasures grant that is just for the bank building itself.
Now, you've mentioned the bank building, and earlier you mentioned, we talked about the restaurant. The original design, the big piece of it was that bank building, and then there was that little restaurant that probably used like a diner or a coffee shop in the day. What are the plans for those pieces of this project?
The west side of the hotel proper will be a full-service restaurant and obviously bar service. The floor of the bank building, what was originally the banking floor, will be used as a multi-purpose community room for weddings or receptions or dinners or conferences, any number of special events.
Martha Huntington of Berglund & Cram, one of the architects working on this project, how long have you been involved in this this whole renovation?
I started working on this 13 years ago, right about now, with a previous owner, and have stayed with the project. Fortunately, we've been reselected every time there's been a new owner working on the job. So, it's been an all-firm effort. Everyone in the office has had a hand in this project in some way.
Ann McGregor is the executive director of Right on the Park. Martha Huntington is with Berglund & Cram Architects, working on the Park Inn Hotel in Mason City. Martha, Ann, thank you very much for joining us on Talk of Iowa.
Thank you.
Architects may come in, architects may go in, never change your point of view.
Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. We're taking your calls. Make a pledge, 800-897-9204. Support Iowa Public Radio. Go to our website, iowapublicradio.org. We appreciate the support that's come through this morning. Next, in an archive interview on Talk of Iowa, we go back to December for a conversation I had with Sherilyn Wally about her new book, The Welsh in Iowa, published by the University of Wales Press. Wally looks at Welsh culture as it was expressed in Middle America by the farmers and coal miners who immigrated to our state, many moving here from states in the east. By no means were the Welsh the biggest immigrant group to Iowa, but these lovers of song quickly adopted. I started by asking Wally why the Welsh chose Iowa.
Well, they came for the same reasons that most everyone else came to Iowa: land, economic opportunity. It was also just that Iowa happened to be the state being settled at the time. A lot of Welsh were moving west, and that's speaking mostly for the agricultural communities. The Welsh who came to mine coal, obviously that was their chosen industry, and that was also more of a coincidence of timing of when our coal mines were active and Welsh happened to be moving west as well and looking for opportunity. Once the first Welsh arrived, most of the rest of the Welsh settlement was the result of chain migration, which we're all familiar with, especially in Iowa, where somebody moves to Iowa, they write letters home, and more relatives follow. This is pretty much the only way the Welsh immigrated throughout history, or at least to America.
Word of mouth, is that what you're saying? I mean, just come to Iowa. The land is great, and it's affordable land, at least for a while.
Right. Word of mouth. There were some booster communities that were trying to get more Welsh to move specifically from Iowa. From Wales to Iowa. Trying to build up communities, but usually it was word of mouth and familial connections. It was also given the choice between striking out completely on your own or settling somewhere where you have a cousin.
Yeah.
You were much more likely to choose where you have family so that you can not only purchase the fellowship, but that gives you economic and social support.
Most people probably don't even realize that Iowa had a lot of Welsh immigrants, because we had so many other immigrants in Iowa, predominantly German. I mean, German is the major group in Iowa. Is that right?
Yes.
And the Welsh are pretty far down on the list. Not quite at the bottom, but getting down there a ways.
Very far down on the list. And they were often mistaken for English or even Yankee immigrants. They assimilated pretty quickly. And a lot of them, especially the Welsh who had already been in America for a generation or two or more, to outsiders, they may have seemed more American than Welsh, and that was always a tension in the Welsh community because they assimilated so well in adopting the English language.
Why did that happen? I mean, the other immigrant groups really stayed much closer together. The Danes, for example, you know, they'd started Danish language newspaper. There was one in Cedar Falls and other places. The Germans, same sort of thing. But the Welsh, as you say, assimilated. And I'm just wondering why they were so good at that.
I think a lot of it had to do with the survival skills they had honed over centuries of English domination back in Great Britain. When they arrived in America, they had already undergone some assimilation to English culture. So they're not, it wasn't quite as foreign. If we take English culture as the dominant strain through American culture in the 19th century, it's not going to be quite as much of a shock for a Welshman to arrive in Philadelphia than for a German or even an Irishman to arrive in Philadelphia. Because of that, the Welsh were a little more comfortable in striking out into the greater culture.
Yeah, forgive me, but did they all speak Welsh, or did some of them come over here speaking English?
Some did come over speaking English. That was more of a class distinction.
In what sense?
If you were more upper class, then you might have gotten English education. If you were the lower classes, you would have spoken Welsh as your native language. And then it's also a matter of timing. The closer we get to the 20th century, the more the people in Wales were having to learn English. So it depends when they came from Wales to America.
You note in your book, Sherilyn, that Welsh is the purest survivor of the Celtic languages. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the Celtic family of languages, you have the old Gaelic or Irish. You have the Scottish Gaelic, which is probably the most diluted of the Celtic languages. You even have Breton. You even have Cornish. Welsh, because of its geographic isolation, in that it has so many valleys that you have a dialect within each valley, they were able to preserve their language the longest and in a more pure form.
I see. And in Wales today, there's just a huge movement to keep the language alive, isn't there?
There is. That I believe it was the 70s was the latest resurgence. And now if you visit Wales, you'll see signs, like official government signs or street signs in English and Welsh. Parents can can decide whether to send their elementary school children on a Welsh track where they learn English second, or on an English track where they learn Welsh second. But Welsh is taught in all the schools, which is a change. It's a big difference from how it was in the mid-20th century when it was very difficult to get any education in Welsh, and the language almost died out.
And when we were talking about, when you mentioned assimilation and how quickly the Welsh assimilated or blended into the Iowa culture and the culture of the United States, what about religion? Because when you look at, you know, for example, the Norwegians and the Swedes, I mean, the big church would be Lutheran, right? But the Welsh didn't really have a church, did they?
There were a couple of distinctions. What they would call their Calvinistic Methodism, we're more familiar with it as strict Presbyterianism. What they call their Congregationalism is almost a Unitarianism.
Really?
So the religious distinctions were not that great. When they would have their own churches so they could, for them, the Welsh language and religion was very intimately tied. And so they would very consciously start their own church, perhaps because their strain of religion was not readily available where they settled, but also as a way to preserve a Welsh culture and a Welsh language.
I suppose most people who have done some research in this automatically connect the Welsh with coal mining, and people maybe have forgotten that Iowa was a coal mining state, at least in some parts of Iowa, south central and southeast. And a lot of the Welsh did become coal miners, more than other groups?
Yes, partly because they had experience.
That's
There's
right.
a huge yeah. Welsh population in Pennsylvania, and of course, a lot of coal mines in Pennsylvania. So they gained experience there, as well as in Wales, and they followed work out to that, to the Iowa coal mines. What's interesting is that very few of them saw the coal mining as the be-all, end-all career move. They saw it as, this is how I'm making money, but I sure do want to be a farmer eventually. And so they, a lot of them did both as long as they could.
Well, the farming had to be a lot easier than the coal mining, right?
Well, it depends what year you're talking about, I suppose.
Well, well, eventually the coal mining totally disappears from the Iowa scene.
It does. It does. A lot of the mines were captive mines. They were owned by the railroads, and they were specifically run in order to provide coal to the railroads. When the railroads rerouted or they obtained other sources of coal, or if the mines themselves played out, then, you know, each mine and even each region of mining would close. And that happened. It wasn't exactly a short period of time that we had the coal boom, but it wasn't a very long or sustained period either.
Talking to Sherilyn Wally, author of the new book, The Welsh in Iowa, you have some great maps in this book, and I'm tracking the Welsh migration or settlements through Iowa. When they started in southeast Iowa, you had a pretty good settlement in Johnson County and Iowa County. But they like other groups, seem to just slowly... They kept moving to the west, and then there's a big settlement in Polk County, Jasper County, Marion County. And by what year, Sherilyn, did they pretty much disappear, or would you consider that, what year would they have totally assimilated?
Well, they haven't all, still. There is still an Iowa Welsh Society, and there are still people in Wales who identify themselves as Welsh Iowans or Welsh Americans, just as there are Norwegian Iowans. The communities were definitely dying down by the 1920s. And some of the resurgence or some of the strong communities you see around that time period in the maps are due to coal mining.
Yeah.
The agricultural settlement is definitely moving from the southeast to the northwest, just like regular or standard Iowa settlement patterns. The anomalies come from the coal mines, because those would jump around. So from one decade to the next, you're going to see, oh, well, all of a sudden all the Welsh are in Mahaska County instead of Monroe County, and that's due to the coal mining. Just like the Germans, and even the Norwegians to an extent, but definitely the Germans, the Welsh were hit by the English First Laws of World War I. And at that point, enough children, American-born, English-speaking children, had been born within the Welsh communities that a lot of churches were struggling over the question of whether to hold services in Welsh or English anyway. So around the World War I period, is when most of them transitioned completely to English, if they had not done so already.
Yeah.
And intermarriage was inevitable as well.
Sherilyn, you write that thousands of Welsh people did not go out of their way to maintain a Welsh identity by affiliating with Welsh institutions. I still find that really interesting. What's the main reason that they turned their back on so much of their own heritage once they got to the United States and specifically to Iowa?
Well, I think by the time they got to Iowa, they'd already been through at least one or two stages of the assimilation process.
Okay.
So they didn't necessarily feel like they were turning their backs on Wales in an abrupt manner. They had just simply decided to become more Americanized. And the American experience, especially for the Welsh, was such that you had to consciously hang on to your heritage if you wanted to retain it. And because the American culture was so easy to assimilate into, especially for the Welsh, because they're so close, although don't tell them I said this, they're so close to the predominating English ethnicity.
Mm.
maybe not by blood and not necessarily by experience, but because they come from Great Britain. In fact, the United States Census went back and forth whether or not to count them separately as from Wales or simply as part of Great Britain. So they, America seemed to group them very much as, oh, okay, you're like the English. And for some, it was just easier to do that, especially if there was nobody else nearby to speak Welsh to, or if religion wasn't that important to them specifically or personally or to their family, then they would go, oh, yeah, I'm an American now, which happened in every ethnic group. You have, it's a very common tale that a first-generation immigrant family will come, and they will raise the second generation. They'll raise their children to be Americans. And sometimes, unfortunately, they refuse to teach them the old language. So you grow up with that second generation, usually able to understand the old language, but not necessarily able to speak more than just a little bit of conversation at home. And then the third generation comes along, and they're the ones that say, whoa, where's my heritage?
Yeah.
And that happened, that the Welsh did that pretty quickly because it was easier for them.
When we look at some of the other ethnic groups and groups who immigrated, we have certain stereotypes that I won't go into. But when, I don't know, I was thinking of the Welsh. I mean, there's, you don't necessarily think of Welsh cooking or Welsh food. No. There's not a real heritage there, is there? But there is, well, we can, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Leeks.
Leeks.
That's about it.
Okay. But then there's this thing called music, and they were really well known for singing. They loved, the Welsh loved to sing. In fact, you say in your book they had a near mania for singing by the end of the 19th century. So what's up with the Welsh and song?
You know, you have to just chalk it up to their culture. They had a very strong bard culture, but the so that kind of lingered throughout the centuries, but the modern, as in the last 150 years, mania for music, it just happened to be what they decided to do with their free time after the mines. In these mining centers in Wales, you had all these single men, and a lot of them, there wasn't that much to do. I mean, as manic as everyone in Wales is these days about soccer or football, as they call it, and rugby, this is how they were about choral societies. And so they started to have very competitive choral societies. So the men's choirs or the male voice choirs are what really became famous in Wales and beyond. And I don't know if there's anything in their national makeup or if it was just a coincidence of choralism catching on at the very same time that you had all these men that needed something to do.
Hmm. Well, it's certainly a nice tradition.
It is. And with that, it's not just the choralism. You have the Gymanfaganis, which it's kind of a hymn-singing festival.
Hmm.
And that revolves around the Welsh Church, which is the center of Welsh culture in America, and to a degree back in Wales. The Eisteddfod, that's that word that's spelled E-I-S-T-E-D-D-F-O-D. It's pronounced Eisteddfod, and that's the cultural competition, often revolving around singing. And it was kind of revived, and it's still to this day is an important competition in Wales.
So getting back to religion for a minute, you always refer to the Welsh going to chapel. They say chapel, mm-hmm. not church. What's the distinction there?
It is the distinction between saying Protestant and Catholic.
Oh, okay.
Only, of course, in England, it's the Church of England, or the Anglican Church. That would be church. And that was considered the state church, and it was considered to be imposed upon the Welsh by the English oppressors. And I'm not overstating it to say it that way. That's how they saw it. So one of their only rebellions that they could do, and the only way to preserve their own culture, they felt, was they became chapel, which was the Protestantism, but not being Anglican. And so they were the Methodists and the Baptists. and even Quakers. And that was very vital to their identity as Welshmen, as, oh, we are chapel. We are not church.
Okay. Sherilyn, we're out of time. This has been a lot of fun. I enjoyed this book so much, The Welsh in Iowa, published by the University of Wales Press. Sherilyn Wally, the author, great book. I think it's the only book of this type that I've ever run into describing the Welsh in Iowa. Very, very good effort. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Sherilyn Wally, again, her book is called The Welsh in Iowa, published by the University of Wales Press.